Hello and welcome to the CG Garage. This is episode number 84 featuring Martin and Ted from IKEA. Very, very excited to have this podcast. I've been wanting to do it for a long time. I met up with Martin when I was at SIGGRAPH a few weeks back, and I really want to sit down and talk to him about all the exciting things he's doing at IKEA. I happen to be joined by my two kids for this podcast intro, and they are going to tell me a little bit. Brady's my youngest. Brady, how old are you?
6 and a half.
And Lily, how old are you?
10.
Okay. So, Brady, do you know IKEA?
Yes.
What do you know about IKEA?
Well, it has practice parts, and then there's this big stuff like beds and couches that you can buy at IKEA.
Beds and couches and stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah? Yeah. And what else do they have? They also have a restaurant there, right?
They do?
Yeah, and you can buy meatballs.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And I love the IKEA meatballs.
And then they have kitchens that are not really real, but they're showing you what it will probably look like.
Yeah, exactly. It's cool. Well, you know that a lot of those things are actually made on a computer. And Martin is part of that group. Very excited to talk to Martin about it. We also looked at virtual reality stuff, right, today. Mm-hmm. I just showed it to you not long ago, right, Brady and Lily?
Yeah.
Yeah? So tell me, Lily, what was your experience like with the virtual reality stuff?
I got to throw meatballs.
You got to throw meatballs? And what else was exciting about it?
I could open drawers virtually it also ended up me bumping into a lot of things, but I could open drawers virtually and pick up spatulas, throw meatballs around the room, which was super fun.
Yeah. Did you like it, Brady?
Yeah, I got to throw meatballs. I picked up the cabbage in the trash and threw the meatball in, and then I threw the cabbage away, and I threw it away from me so it'd never get near me again. And then I opened
some drawers.
Yeah. And I couldn't, and I needed help opening the. Closing the oven and opening it, but I didn't really care.
Yeah. Was it kind of like being in an IKEA store with your pretend kitchens?
Yeah, except I saw the little dots like you see on TVs.
Oh, right.
I saw that.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And there were also like actual food that if you threw it around in the room, you would get in trouble.
And Lily, you were pretending to eat the meatball.
I tried.
Yeah,
I ended up with something in my mouth. I forgot what it was.
The controller, right.
Oh, yeah, I ended up with a controller in my mouth.
Well, it was fun. I think it was really cool. I think another thing that was interesting, Lily, because we mentioned it's on the podcast, you got to set your settings so that you could be tall like me, right?
Oh, yeah. I got to see the kitchen from Dad's point of view, and I'm glad I'm short now.
Yeah?
I never wanted to do that again because I want to be normal size.
You want to be a little kid size, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was cool. All right, guys. Thanks so much for that, and I really appreciate it. This is a very exciting and fun podcast. I love talking to Martin. He's always fun, and hopefully you guys enjoy it. All right. Thank you, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the chaos group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
Okay, 1, 2, 3, perfect.
Okay.
Yep.
Is that okay?
Yeah, it's good.
So,
you know, you're like the third Swedish person I've had on this podcast.
Okay.
Well, no, third Swedish podcast, shall we say. Because
okay.
I've had several Swedes before, but coffee is like one of the most important things in Sweden. Is that
yeah, right? we can't live without it. No.
And you have designated coffee breaks by...
Yeah, we call it fika.
Fika, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. That's a coffee break when you actually are socializing.
Right.
So it's not coffee at your desk, sitting with the computer. It's
right.
Actually doing and sitting and talking to people. And at the office, actually, we have only one place where you can get coffee. So everybody from the whole building has to go there. So it mixes up people.
By design.
Yeah, actually.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because they did the same thing at Herzog and de Meuron and the architecture company. They have two coffee breaks, one in the morning, one in the late afternoon.
Okay.
And everyone goes there and they socialize. That's their social. And they have like some cookies and cakes and stuff like that as well.
It's the same thing.
I like that. Yeah. I like that. It's a good tradition.
Yeah.
It's better than lunch, I think, almost.
and I don't think it's very like thought of. It's just the way things are in Sweden. So
right.
It's all the same in homes and everywhere. So.
Yeah. It's like tea time in England, I guess,
right? Yeah, I guess. Yeah.
All right. So let me think the last time you and I were in Anaheim was it 4 years ago or 5 years ago? When was the last SIGGRAPH here?
Last SIGGRAPH here? No, this wasn't. It was before Vancouver, so it must have been 2013, maybe? Or no, 2014.
2014, right?
Yeah, okay, yeah.
So that means it was the... right, so it was about 2014. No, it was before 2014. Because it was before I was at Chaos Group. I was
That's
still
the 10-year anniversary for V-Ray.
No, that was after that.
Okay.
So, point being, I think the last Anaheim SIGGRAPH, which I'll be corrected when it was, or I will remember suddenly, was the first time I met you.
Okay, yeah.
It was V-Ray days. It was the first V-Ray days, right?
Mm, yeah.
And it was the first time I met you, and I was actually a speaker for V-Ray days then because I was still working at Digital Domain. And what was interesting about that was that I saw your presentation. I said, oh, just someone from IKEA is going to be speaking. I didn't think of what it was going to be like. And it was a fascinating talk, which you have since refined, developed, and given more of that all around the world now, right?
Yeah, a few times. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was finally recorded like a few months ago. So now I don't have to do it anymore.
Okay. Well, we'll go through a quick version of that at some point so I can let people know what's good about it.
Yeah.
But what I'm interested in is... when did you start at IKEA and what was your position when you started there?
Yeah, if you go back really long, I really wasn't supposed to be doing what I'm doing now at all. I was supposed to be a microbiologist. That was my dream from early age.
Okay.
Then for different reasons, a computer ended up in my home because my father got one. And
why did you want to be a microbiologist? What was fascinating to you?
My brother is 10 years older and he's a professor now in microbiology. Would like to go and do the things he did because it was, I guess...
Seemed cool.
Yeah, it was cool looking down microscopes, you know, doing those kind of things. And I'm super interested in those kind of things still. But
right.
But... then a small little computer ended up in my home and my father was like working. So I was 12, 13. And you know, you those computers, if you put them on, it was just a marker on an upper left corner. It's blinking and it's nothing else. And,
nope.
and next to the machine, I don't know if my father did that on purpose. It was a learn basic.
Uh-huh.
So I started.
Yep.
So, and... I guess my brain is wired in a way that...
How long ago was this, in the 80s?
This is in 79, 80.
Right.
Somewhere now.
Yep.
And then like 1 or 2 years after that, I started earning money programming.
Mm-hmm.
So like I was next at the same time as high school, I did administrative solutions in a 32K RAM computer without disks or anything.
Yep.
And I continued doing that and I... You know, you have your summer job, and I didn't because I did that in the evenings, and I got better computers, and I didn't have to work in the summers because I couldn't really, because I already earned what I could do according to what the Swedish tax says. So I was free all summers, but I was doing that, and so I became a programmer,
really. Right?
Programming normal administrative systems and database stuff and writing a database engine and those kind of things. That's what I did.
Sure.
And then in 1990, I stumbled upon 3D graphics. I was actually locked into a room. It sounds bad, but it was good. Saw two movies from Autodesk, one from Tom Hudson had done
mm-hmm.
first in the first DOS version of 3D Studio.
Right.
And another movie that I hadn't seen until like a month ago, those two movies. And I saw though that was 5 minutes long and I was totally taken. And I've been so passionate about 3D and computer graphics ever since. I didn't know how to earn money on it and I didn't know what to do to, but I knew that I had to work with this.
Mm-hmm.
So when I stepped out in that room, the Autodesk people that I was visiting, they asked me if I wanted to be a reseller. And I said, yes, I had no clue what that was.
What that was.
Or I never had my own company or uh-huh. anything. So I just started it and there was no customers.
Right.
So I had to start working with it at the same time and actually got IKEA as a customer in 92.
Oh,
when I still run the company in my bedroom.
Wow.
Yeah. And selling 3D Studio like in '90s, '96 when 3D Studio Max was coming out, I became the biggest reseller in Scandinavia.
Oh wow.
Had my own little company and in '98 I sold it all.
Right.
And started working as a consultant instead.
Uh-huh.
And doing animation work, doing storyboarding, and I've been programming and doing plugins for 3D Studio all along.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so that was your thing. You were like an Uber Max guy in Scandinavia.
Yeah, mixed artist, mixed programming guy, those kind of things, yeah. And selling and
doing animation.
Yeah, and being an expos, doing like a demo jockey thing.
Right.
So
right.
Doing all those kind of things.
Yeah.
And training people. I think I during the '90s I trained like 400 or 500 Swedes in 3D.
Okay. Yeah.
Everything from 2 days things up to a half a year.
Right. And so how did you, obviously you said IKEA was one of your big customers, your first customers, right?
Yeah.
And then how did you, and you must have had a strong relationship with them, and then how did you end up going there?
Yeah, you know, working as a consultant in different ways, like almost since I was 12 until, yeah, in like 25 years or something like that, then you want to go over to the other side.
Uh-huh. And be yeah.
And when the opportunity came, it was one of my former employees when I had my own company who started working there. And then a position came up. So, and he called me and I went there and then I got the job. So I started in 2007 and the job was to try to make 3D run in large scale at IKEA to
okay.
create images. That was it. And yeah. when I started, the team grew from three people to five or something.
Was it mainly for visualization?
Design? Yeah, still images.
So, was it for designing purposes, or
was there an
intent to actually create
photorealism? No, that was the scary part. It was not previous that what I've done before.
Right.
This was facing customers. It should be photoreal.
Right.
Yes.
So this is a big challenge now. 2007. Well, 2007. I guess it was definitely possible. There was photorealistic rendering at that point.
Yeah, it was. And I hadn't been working with V-Ray then. I was mainly, I've been working with Brazil and Mental Ray
yeah.
and, you know, all those other render engines that was out there. But they had really started using V-Ray. And when I came in, I was actually doing animations and all that the first half year.
Okay.
So, and then I learned how it worked and it was super nice starting out with that.
Okay, and so that became the goal. So, let's go through. I love some of the stories that you talk. And in fact, I paraphrase you often because
okay.
a lot of people ask me about IKEA or whatever, or relationships between photography and visualization. But I think first of all, I think it's find it very uniquely Swedish to. Cross-discipline people and make sure that everyone is trained and equal and non-competitive in a way, right?
Yeah.
So you guys had a photography group.
Yeah.
Or still do, probably.
Yeah, yeah. Still as big as before.
Right.
Yeah.
So the photography group then was basically photographing furniture and sets and scenarios, and that goes the IKEA catalog.
Been doing for so many years.
Yeah. The IKEA catalog is famous, right? Mm-hmm. It's a book that comes out. Everyone admires it, and obviously mm-hmm. it's also available on the web.
Mm-hmm.
But that book, it was primarily all photographed, and then the 3D group came in and tried to match as closely as possible, right?
Yeah.
And then tell the story about how these two groups cross-pollinated and what the philosophy was between that.
Yeah, the Just to back a little bit, the initial idea using 3D was to create still images of single products.
Single products.
Yeah, that was the only use case in the beginning.
A chair.
Yeah, a chair on white background. You know those volume things we normally do.
Yep.
But as soon as we got that in and we could see it and we did tests with rooms and room sets, people saw that, yeah, this could work too.
Right.
So, yeah, of course, that then is the same as we do in the physical sets in the studio and, mm-hmm. and a huge studio that we have. And but the people we got in from the beginning were, yeah, fairly young and tech savvy people. And most of them didn't have any like photographer background.
Okay.
No. And then we had the team of photographers that most of them had been at IKEA for 10, 15, almost in some 20 years doing images that looks like IKEA images and have been working with painting and painting with light. That's really what they do.
Yeah.
And they have been doing this for so long. And
there's a style to it that's important, right?
Yeah. And they were actually not sitting together at all. And yeah, of course, if you don't, then it's you get a little bit of a competition mm-hmm. between the two groups. There were people who bridged that and helped and so on in a very good way. But still, it didn't really take off.
Right. And
so we had a reorganization, as all companies have. And somebody did a brilliant move and put the 3D artist and the photographers under the same manager.
That's, okay.
Yeah. And she came to me and she had a, for me, brilliant idea. I would love to have had that myself. And she said, okay, could we make it possible for everyone that is a photographer to become a junior 3D artist and every 3D artist to become a junior photographer?
Right.
And we said, yeah, of course, it will take a little bit of time. Yeah, but we will set aside 3 years and we will put people away and staff up.
Right.
On the other side. So we will take the first two photographers that are willing and are keen on learning, and they will start out, and they will. We sent them away to Vlado, actually, had the first.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So you
trainings
sent them
to Bulgaria.
To Sofia? Nice.
Yeah, yeah. So they went down there. And then when they came home, they got some tasked to do some still images of single products, and then we had a new training, and we continued that for half a year.
Okay.
And we did the opposite also, but then we have the sets and we have everything internally. So what happened was that the 3D artist like had a mentor from the photographers and learned how to set things in the studio. So
right.
We did that with
real set dressing.
Yeah, the same thing. So and. At the same time, I'm and my team were looking into, okay, now we get a lot of photographers in here. So, okay, they would like to have that's what it feels like a camera. And we need to create bouncers and all the lighting things so mm-hmm. they feel comfortable. And we had Autodesk looking at a totally new interface for 3D Studio. And we started that for a month.
Mm-hmm.
And then the photographers came back from Sofia and said, okay, you don't need to do that.
Right.
Okay. We don't want it. Okay.
Yeah.
Why? Okay. Now it's so easy. We just set it where we normally do and it works.
Right.
So we can use all the tips and tricks and all the things that we learned for 20 years in real world photography, and all those things works.
And so they were able to make the translation pretty easily, right?
Yeah, it's a tool, but most of them know Photoshop and those kind of tools, and
sure.
3D software is a little bit more complicated than that, but it's still a software, so it's not
right.
that hard. But knowing where you put like reflectors, where you put where you put the light, where you put like big black boxes to get reflections
sure.
where you want, it worked exactly like in real world. So
sure.
that also meant when the 3D artist wanted to have an effect, now the photographers could really teach them how to do that, because
right.
then it's in the real world. In real world, you do like this.
So they were. That's I think what's so fascinating. And now people say they do that, but obviously the lighters that I know that are mm-hmm. really good, or compositors I know are really good, are also excellent photographers, right?
Yeah.
So that role of teaching each other stuff must have been really interesting. What did the 3D guys learn from? Obviously, the 3D guys learned set dressing.
Yeah.
That was probably the biggest thing that they learned, right?
Yeah, and if you look at how we create images for like brochures and catalogs and everything, we use flashlights. You don't see that, but we in the studio, it's no constant lighting.
Okay. Yeah. So it's strobes.
It's strobes. Yeah. So if you look at a scene without taking an image, it looks like nothing.
Right.
So you, it's the same thing as rendering.
I guess you're right. It's interesting you say that. Okay, so I'm going to go back to another story because I think you'll relate to it. There's Eric Nash, who is someone who's been on my podcast, and he was a VFX supervisor at Digital Domain, but he was never a 3D person. He was a DP, right? He was a DP for miniatures and stuff. So he knew how to light sets and do everything else. And so this was back during iRobot, I told him, you know, he wanted to learn how lighting works on computers, right? Mm. And since he didn't know. And so he sat at my desk and he said, show me how you light. And I was showing him, he's like, wow, this is unbelievably painful. You have to wait for all these renderings. This is a long time ago. Mm. You have to wait for these renderings. And I said, yeah. And he goes, it would be like me going on set, turning off all the lights and say, okay, turn it on. No, that didn't work. Now turn them all off and move them and then turn it on again. So just waiting and waiting and waiting was a process. But I guess to the guys with strobes is the same thing. They have to move the light and then take the photograph and see the effect.
You
right?
get instant rendering almost. Right.
But you still have to move the light.
You still have to move the right light. And then, of course, then that's only the movement of the light. But if you then want to make a room set that looks like it's lit from sunlight coming in, but you have a flashlight.
Right.
And you have this and that. You have to think about the colors of the light and how you set them and what you set in front of them and everything to get the feeling. Mm-hmm. So they are really used to, like I said, paint with light.
Right.
So when they look at an image, they say, okay, the lights coming in from the windows are not warm enough or too cold or whatever it is.
Sure.
And so on. So, and that's, I think, is one of the success factors in this. When we started with 3D and we got photographers in and helping us and looking at that, they didn't say, oh, it's a bad image, and then go out. They could say, okay, this is a bad image because the light here is not the right color. They shouldn't be like this. This makes it feel so. And in the studio, we would have done this and so on. So it was really, really constructive. So and I think that really almost like, so much took off when we mixed the teams and they worked together all the time and sitting next to each other. So it was a photographer, 3D artist, actually in the office space.
Right.
Yeah, in the beginning. I don't think it's so now, but in the beginning, that was the way they mixed the groups.
But now it must be like it must be a lot of synergy at this point. Everyone's sort of thinking.
Yeah, and actually some 3D artists are only photographers now.
Really?
And the opposite has also happened.
Wow.
So some photographers has gone over and only doing CG. So it's a mix.
How many people do you have total in that department?
I should know this, but I think the team is fairly stable at about 25.
Okay.
All of them 25, 30, and half of them CG, half of them photographers. So it's somewhere there.
And so the catalog itself, how much of it is CG? And how much is photography? That's a big debate.
It's always a question. it depends. A catalog contains about, I think it's 1,800 images.
Uh-huh.
That is room-like images. And we do 10,000 of those each year. So the catalog is actually a small portion of everything we do.
Sure.
So it depends from year to year and where we have capacity and where it's, if they do images that is easy to do in CG or not, and if you have render power or floor space, depending on, because that's the two limited things we have, floor space in the studio and render times in CG. They are the same. You manage them the same way.
Yeah. Accessibility.
Yeah, and I think last year, now we get a new catalog in 2 weeks, so I don't know for that one. But in last year's catalog, I think they said they made 81 sets.
81 sets.
Yeah, and I think 13 of them were worth CG in that one.
Okay.
Yeah. But if you take the 10,000 images, about 35% of those,
or
3,500, is CG.
Okay.
If you look at the product images that we made 45,000 last year, about 70% is 3D.
Okay. Well, that makes sense.
It's still there. That is the large portion.
The large portion. Well, that makes sense. You just like, you, yeah.
And if you like 5-6 years ago, we made about 10,000-12,000 images total, all categories.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then going to 55,000 now,
right,
with the same staff.
Right.
Yeah. So and the huge volume increase here is taking CG.
Right.
But we do more normal photography than ever, so okay, the studio is packed with,
gotcha,
things. So this, we still have lack of floor space. We still have a lot of things going on there at the same time.
So. Right, right, right. So what's also interesting is you told a story about why there was an advantage to use CG for certain sets depending on the culture of the place where the catalog was going. You would make a change.
The kitchens is the big pain point.
Okay, so explain the kitchens.
Yeah, it's very the floor layout of a kitchen is very different than different parts of the world.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah.
I can imagine in Japan, it's going to be much smaller.
Yeah, but and they have an extension out that they use for storage and so on. And in Europe, if you are in a high building, you will have like an eye-like kitchen, ending up with a window or something in the end, and a very tight thing.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so many different possibilities for kitchen and how they use kitchen in different parts of the world. And almost all countries have different white goods.
Okay.
So if the stove, the fans, everything is different, and you have fish fryers in Japan, and you have so many different things. So if you have one kitchen and we make an image for 43 countries, we have to exchange all those kind of things. Otherwise, it doesn't look like for their country.
Right.
So
a Japanese kitchen wouldn't sell well in the United States.
No, if it doesn't have those things in there that is theirs, then it looks strange.
Right, right,
right. If some countries don't have gas stoves, then right, a gas stove would look strange, and right, the opposite.
Right.
So to be able to cover the world, it can be that one kitchen becomes like 15.
Uh-huh.
And of course, in each country, you only see one of them. But
15 variations of that
variations,
kitchen.
Variations, yeah. But then when you exchange a stove with another stove, then maybe that's 1 inch off, and then you have to move everything.
Right.
And if you have if the kitchen ends with a window in one country and in another country ends with like a storage area,
right,
then we have to rebuild. And, you know, tiling and everything, it's costly and it takes up a lot of time.
And CG is much quicker to do that.
Yes.
Right.
So if we would only build a set and only do it for one country, I would guess that it will be as expensive as doing it in real life.
Right.
But gotcha. As soon as we have different country and variations, it just is a no-brainer to use CG.
Yeah, I guess it's almost, you can almost think of it like a car configurators, right?
Yeah.
So in car configurators, you have, you know,
left
different
steering,
bumpers,
right steering,
steering. Yeah, you just swap this out, this bumper package and this luxury package, these wheels. So.
Yeah, I think those have cultural differences and like geographical variants, but like inside people's homes is even more
personal.
Yeah, yeah. More personal and more geographically changeable.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting.
I'm not an expert. I'm just hearing what the other people say.
No, but you're executing this thing.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting that happened. So when was that first time that you guys sent your photographers to Sofia? How long ago was that? Around 2009 or so?
I think this is 2009, 2010. At the same time as we started to build a huge 3D model library. That was at the same time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, you've done a lot of other interesting things. You're not just doing renderings. You're continuing to innovate, find new things to do, et cetera. So,
yeah.
And we'll get to the VR stuff
because
I'm sure people are fascinated by that. But I remember you're also talking about materiality. I want to talk about materiality. So that's obviously something that's very important when you're doing furniture, the way something looks.
Yeah.
So how do you guys create? You must create a library of materials. And how do you do that?
Yeah, that was when I was hired in the beginning, we did everything from scratch every time.
Sure.
So yeah, taking SolidWorks files, converting, building things, adding a flower, whatever we needed for a set. And then we rendered it and then we threw it away. Of course, we reused whatever we needed, but we built what we needed
sure.
for every set. And of course, that's not super. And it takes a little bit of a time because, you know, it's in this kind of business, everything moves fast. So sure. so it was like, yeah, it was a hinder not having the assets ready.
Sure.
But we also got an internal project that they called a virtual store.
Okay.
It was really, from my point of view, a perfect store because it was how it looks before any customers get in there.
So okay. Yeah.
Everything is fully stacked. Nothing is moved. All the labels and everything is in the right place.
Yep.
And that was a project they wanted us to run. And we were running on fairly small machines compared to today, like 4 CPUs, 8 threads, like 16 gigs of RAM. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to load this huge amount of things, like 100. Yeah, it was so big. I was just before I started IKEA, I worked with Volvo and made their first digital car. And I remember the numbers of how many polygons and everything and how much that was with all interior and everything and photoreal and so on. And the problem here that one section of an IKEA store was like 25 times that in low res.
Right.
And they wanted to have like bird's eye views
of the entire store.
And going close so you see like one plate and the label for that.
Wow.
Up and down. So we needed to have... We built level of details of every model and automatic swapping of all that. And I remember loading it took 45 minutes. Rendering took 10 minutes.
Wow.
So just loading it in. Yeah. But what I'm coming for too is that we built the library back then. And we did about 2,000, 2,500 models for that project. And we made them all wrong, unfortunately.
Why is that?
We didn't build them according to or connected to the polygon or the resolution of the object was not connected to real world size. We worked with something else. So if we had a tea candle and a sofa with the same like polygon or level or LOD level, the sofa was so much less information in than the other one. So it didn't really work.
Mm-hmm.
And then one other thing was that we created the materials for each object, like so it was self-contained.
Okay.
And then if we had four artists making their red door front for a series, they looked so different. So what we did was that we separated when we did it again, we had to throw away all those 2,500 models. They couldn't work.
Yeah.
And so we separated the model library from the material library from the texture library.
Okay.
So they're running their own number series.
Mm-hmm.
So what that means is that if we have a certain type of oak, that is that we may create a texture for that and has its own ID number. And it's a huge texture. It's like 2.5 meter, 1.5 meter, and like 125 pixels per inch.
Okay.
So it's like 30K, 10K, something, or even bigger. But we only need one for all those made by that oak, because we can slide the geometry within the UV channel and we get the variations we need.
Mm-hmm.
So every time we load a model with that oak material, we load, we don't take the material that's in the max file, we actually load the new material and then update the textures.
Okay.
So every time you take something into the scene, you get the latest version of that.
Okay.
That means also that we have some products that use like we have 4,000, not 4,000, but like 150, 250 products that has the same materials in a series for a kitchen cabinet or something.
Sure.
Yeah, okay, a door front or something. But if we update the material, we don't have to open the files because that's one material.
Okay.
So the library we have now has about 32,000 3D models.
Okay.
And only 6,000 materials.
Right.
And about 10,000 textures.
Right. Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah. So now when we are updating things, it's so much easier for us. It's really for maintenance.
It's a database system.
Yeah, it's a debate. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It comes back from where I was doing before.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's really cool. So this gives you your entire library. You've got a texture library, material library, and a model library. Yeah. And then they each cross-reference what they need from each other, right?
Yeah. And then we, of course, we have a what we call a propping library. And then propping library is things that we don't sell. So like flowers or shoes or clothes.
Yeah, the cookie jar that you told me, I love that story. Because basically it's hard to 3D place perfect cookies.
Yeah.
So you guys made a tool to make perfectly placed cookies.
Yeah, going back to the when we thought we would send away the photographers to those trainings, mm-hmm. we thought we had to simplify the user interface. But what they really told us when they came back is that no, the only thing we need is an easy way to find assets, place assets, move assets, replace assets, everything around the assets.
Right.
That's what we need.
It was about set dressing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we built a web-based a browser for it, and then we connected that with 3D Studio. So whatever you do in the web browser is connected to the scene, so you can load and unload and do all those kind of things.
Nice.
And then we built our own little movement mode in 3D Studio. You normally you have move, rotate, and scale.
Yes.
Yeah, in all tools, move, right. rotate, and scale.
Yeah.
They are not super obvious.
Right.
For more than CG people.
Right.
So if you have take somebody that is not being used to using that, they, okay, what happens now? I rotated it, but doesn't it fall to the floor? No, we don't have gravity.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And then, of course, it will intersect with things. It's like working with holograms in space.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's hard to get people to understand that. So what we did was creating a simple movement mode that we called pick and place.
Okay.
It's very easy to implement, really. It's just an intersect ray straight in the scene, and whatever it hits, we put it on. So,
right.
And then we built that in 2010, I think, or uh-huh. 2010, 2011, and then we run it ourselves for a few years, and then we persuaded Autodesk to put it in.
Yeah, it's just basically like put a cup on a table, and it's going to be perfectly
yeah.
placed on a table.
And that's what you do
or
a lot
knife.
When you're dress setting. You're
sure.
moving things.
Or a knife or a fork
yeah.
or a placemat or whatever.
Yeah, and then, of course, we connect it to the database stuff. So if you select five things and you say, okay, I want to replace this with these five things, then mm-hmm. it unloads them, loads the other, use the same transforms, and just it's placed in the same
place. In the same place.
Making those replacement of things.
Right.
Yeah.
But the other thing you did with the cookie jar was funny because you just basically hovered these cookies and...
Yeah, but that's the rest of the problem.
Okay.
The pick and place things works for like 60% of moving hard body stuff.
Right.
Because that doesn't need gravity and collision.
Right.
It's just moving things on top of flat surfaces, mainly.
Sure.
But then if you want to put something into something, like cutlery in drawers, that's we do a lot. Mm-hmm. Pens in a cup or, yeah, placing things on top of something. Or books in a bookshelf, actually.
Right.
Then you need to have gravity.
Right.
And you need to have collision.
Right.
So what we did was looking for a physics engine, and we tested a few, and we decided to do run Bullet. That's mm-hmm. an open source one. And then we like extended 3D Studio with Bullet.
Okay.
Yeah. So and of course there are physics simulators connected to any tool today. So that mm-hmm. that's not the problem. The problem is that they are so hard to set up.
Right.
So we wanted a single button thing. So
right.
everything that's hidden in the scene is not part of it. Mm-hmm. Everything that is selected is part of the simulation, and everything that is not selected is unyielding, just bouncing off that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's that's the setup.
Mm-hmm.
And
so you,
you hide things and you select the things that you want to be affected by gravity. You press a button and then it runs.
Wow.
So we fill macaroni in jars. That's, I see that a lot.
Right.
Cornflakes.
Right.
Yeah, whatever. And cutlery in drawers is also a very nice
So you basically
example.
Have like, you know, you had the example you showed was like a jar full of cookies and you just had
yeah.
these floating cookies and it's like, all right, gravity. And then the cookies yeah. would... settle and all collide yeah. correctly. But then
or
you have
if you take a the demo I usually show is a stack of plates.
Right.
Yeah. And normally when if you use an array tool, the human eye will see that it's super perfect.
Right.
And it looks strange.
Right.
But if it's like half a millimeter off
yeah.
in every direction, it's okay again.
Right.
It looks like it's neatly done, but it's not too perfect.
Right. So how did you do that?
Yeah, we that was an idea I had. Was that I would like to add a like shake of some kind. We call it earthquake mode. Maybe you shouldn't call it that.
Not in California.
But yeah, I know. I haven't felt it yet. But we call it earthquake mode.
So you basically just shake it up so that they
yeah,
just
they,
slip a little
the
bit.
The thing
right?
is that you can interact with it. So you can drag things with the mouse. But mm-hmm. if you just want to shake, then you press the Alt key and you get a slowly higher earthquakey thing. And mm-hmm. as soon as you release the Alt key, then it's gone.
Right.
So and they use it for other things too. I thought that they would like shake up things so it will fall, like arrange itself better or something.
Sure.
But they use it a lot for bookshelves, actually.
Interesting.
So they place out books, yeah, and then they select them. Even if they are standing nicely on the bookshelf, mm-hmm, they simulate it and they press this Alt key, uh-huh, and then it shakes the books a bit.
Right.
And if they do that, then you get that irregularity. Yeah. Or if you have papers or newspapers in a stack.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The same thing. Just they are like neatly, like perfectly arrayed.
Right.
And then you press that and they're starting sliding.
Nice.
And that's nice enough.
Yeah. I think that's so important. All those details are nice and they give it a nice little sort of human touch to it a little bit, right?
And we, so, yeah. The irregularity. And unfortunately, or fortunately, I don't know, but unfortunately for us, the look and feel of the IKEA images is that they should look lived in.
Right.
It's not like the first time you enter your new house.
Right.
Nothing in there. Nobody has touched and made something. Right. It should feel like somebody has just left for going out and getting something.
Right.
So it's a lot of detail, a lot of things there all over. And they almost, yeah, and sometimes they actually put like fingerprints on glasses and, you know, those kind of things. Really? Just to make it feel right.
That's cool. Yeah. That's really cool. All right. So let's talk a little bit about some of your new adventures. You've been sort of delving into VR, and I guess you were just telling me how you're having a lot more meetings at SIGGRAPH this year because of all this work you've done in VR. Now, you've been doing this for a little bit, and we've known a little bit about it, obviously.
Yeah.
But now that it's a little bit more public, why don't you tell people what you guys have been exploring?
Yeah, it all happened, all went public the 5th of April when we released the VR, not game, but experience that we call IKEA VR Experience.
Uh-huh.
But it actually tracks back to 2010.
Right.
Yeah, so that's when we started.
Right.
So we have been playing with it for a few years. But in 2010, we tried to use very early versions of WebGL connected with actually V-Ray in the back end,
mm-hmm, yeah,
rendering. So we placed things and we sent it over to the server. The server was firing up and loading in the high-res stuff, rendering and getting it back in 10 seconds. And it worked.
Right.
It worked nicely. The only problem is that we have a lot of customers on our webpage.
Right.
So we couldn't scale it. So it didn't work.
Right.
In 2012, we tried again, but then we tried on client side. But we have a lot of objects, things that we sell that is like, yeah, it's challenging, like highly reflective stuff and refractive stuff,
right,
and so on. And they didn't look good. So we had to stop that then too. But in 2014,
was it the idea of basically someone would go on your website and then be able to configure their own kitchen?
Yeah, the idea here was actually just to show one single product without making a pre-render.
Okay.
So making it look photoreal, that's been the goal all the time.
Sure.
And then 2014, so many things happened at the same time. So I persuaded some people internally at IKEA, we need to prepare for real time. It will come.
Yep.
In a few years. So we started a project that we were aiming for 2020.
Mm-hmm.
It's nice to work at a company where you actually can have those kind of plans.
Yes, exactly.
So we did. And then in the fall 2014, I think this is, I stumbled upon and I was invited over to Valve.
Yeah.
And was like brought into a room the 4th of December, actually. I remember it.
Uh-huh.
They put on those terrible looking early versions of the HTC Vive.
Yeah.
And I was told not to put my hands on in front of because it was open like circuit boards.
Right.
So you get electrified.
Right.
But any case, yeah, I was into that virtual world for like about 2 hours. And that was the first time I stepped on the other side of the screen.
Uh-huh.
And for me, that was a reboot or reboost or refill on my passion of 3D. Because I've been staring at that side like for 25 years,
yeah,
and never been able to walk
through the screen.
Yeah, I've seen, no, walk through the screen, and yeah, now I was there. It was super simple graphics. Yeah, it was not fancy at all,
yeah,
but still, you were there.
Mm-hmm.
And when I came out of that, then they asked me, do you want to have one of the early versions?
Sure.
And I said, yeah.
Yeah, of course.
And we got in January 2015. And a few weeks later, we had our first test up and running, and we got some of the managers in that, and they were totally amazed.
Yeah.
So then they started a project. So we were taking one of the kitchens from the current IKEA catalog. It will be replaced in 2 weeks, but the one people have at home, right now.
Uh-huh.
It's page 13, 14 somewhere. It's a kitchen. And we built that during summer, and we have an internal IKEA event starting in November, ending in February, where we have all people from all over the IKEA world coming to the mothership in Sweden and seeing all the new range. But we also had 4 rooms where we showed this.
Okay.
So they could come down and test it. So we run through 1,000 employees.
Okay.
Through this, and the response was awesome.
Gotta take a long time.
It took a long time. Mm-hmm. It was 15-minute things, and then I sat outside and having a debrief with them. And these are non-gamers,
right?
All of them, and mainly about 30. Mm-hmm. So not the target range for VR at the moment, at least.
Well, because you and I are going to have a talk about that in general, but keep going.
Yeah. But the thing was that it was so amazing to see how they grasped the idea of walking around in the space directly. Yeah. We didn't have to tell them.
No.
No, it just worked.
It's intuitive.
Yeah.
Because it's the way you work in real life.
Yeah. So we do that, all that. And that's, as that went so well, we were allowed to release it publicly. And we did that the 5th of April. And the response from that was like overwhelming.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah,
we got YouTube videos like 4 hours after we released, and we hadn't done any videos. We hadn't just like it was 5 images,
right?
And it, like no boring press release, like wall of text thing.
Yeah,
that was the only thing we put out there, and we didn't know if anyone would react, but it was huge.
Right. Well, and it makes so much sense.
And the idea was that we put this out and see how people react, and maybe we can get some feedback.
Yeah,
like co-creation thing, like getting some user feedback and what do you want us to do with this and so on. So I was prepared with the team and everything, but I wasn't prepared for what they wanted.
What did they want?
Meatballs.
Oh, right.
It was a kitchen.
But those meatballs are so good.
Yeah.
I love the meatballs.
So I actually asked internally, and I was allowed to add meatballs. So like 15 days after the release or something like that, we added meatballs, and the social media response was awesome again. So
yes, and it should be.
Yeah. So they're in there.
My wife laughs at me when I go to IKEA and get meatballs because I just love it. It's like, but you just had lunch. Yes, but they're good.
So you can actually grab them now. There's also vegetables because we sell them too. You can actually fry them, and steam will come up, and the fan is on, and you can. People are just playing with it, and they are doing a lot of fancy stuff. You should know. It's a 5-minute thing.
Sure.
Yeah, it's not more than that, but people like you, sometimes they refer to it as a game, and it's not.
It's not.
No. But and okay, some people say, okay, why do you do this? Why are you looking into this? And I said, okay, have you been in an IKEA store?
Yeah.
Yeah, the second floor. Yeah. You know those rooms that are up there?
Yeah.
Nobody lives there.
Right. Right.
They are virtual.
Right.
Now, okay, they are made for you to come into and look around and experience and go out in about 5 minutes.
Right.
Yeah. This is the same thing.
It's the same thing, except you don't have to, you don't have to go to IKEA.
Yeah, it's the same concept.
Right.
So the thing we've done now is following a concept we have had for like 30 years.
Yeah.
So it's nothing new.
It's nothing
new. It's just a new media.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. But I also like the fact that, you know, go back to what we were just talking about earlier, where the CG, you can change it. Like, let's see it in red cabinets. Let's see it in blue cabinets. Let's see with a toaster here. Let's see with this. I go to the second floor in IKEA.
Yeah.
I'm not frying meatballs up there.
No, you should. Maybe.
Yeah. Well, I don't think it wouldn't be very safe for me to fry meatballs in the IKEA store. No. I'll leave that to the professionals. No. But the ability to actually live there or find, you know, to pretend live there more than, because if I go to the second floor in IKEA, that's great. It's really cool because he's like, oh yeah, that gives me an idea of what I can do in my, that's the whole point, right?
Yeah.
This is how I can configure my room, because some people, they can't see it. So you have to show it to them.
Of course, that's the reason why we have it. Yeah.
So, but you do it in virtually, it's more than that, because you can actually interact with it a little bit more in some ways, and change it or try different things.
Yeah, the little 5-minute thing we've done, you can change to 3 different colors. You can open some drawers. You can see why it's interesting or maybe functionally very nice to have like recycle bin where we put it and so on. And mm-hmm. What we also did, and that was actually me having an idea, was because IKEA has a few like long-term priorities, like living with children is one of them.
Yes. Yeah.
So an idea I had was, okay, this is virtual. Can we shrink you to child size?
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, of
course.
Because
then you can see the world in that perspective, and seeing these things from other people's perspective gives you a new view of life, whatever it is.
That's brilliant.
So I figured out a way of doing it like how I would have done it, and we tested it, and it was awesome.
Really?
Really awesome.
But everything got big, right?
Yeah, and the thing, I mean, when we were running that through like 1,000 people, I had a few people coming out and say, you have unlocked memories.
Yeah, of course.
Now I remember how I looked at the world when I was small. And right. We are shrinking people down to about 3 feet, like 95 centimeters.
Right.
The eye height is at that level.
Right.
And what we actually do is that if you stand in the environment, then we know how high up the headset is.
So, right, of course.
Yeah, so we can use that as a reference, and then we shrink you down so your eye height will be at 93 centimeters.
Right.
And that's like, depending on how fast you grow, it's like 3-4 years old.
Right.
Something like that.
So you can experience an IKEA kitchen at the age of 3, even though you're 45.
Yeah, and walk around and then open drawers, and they are scary. They are scary.
Yeah, the drawers
are. And a frying pan becomes something you want to sit in.
Right.
And you know, underneath the kitchen island is a space where we have rolled in a like some kind of storage thing.
Uh-huh.
But that becomes a space you want to go in and play in.
Yeah.
Even if you're old now,
yeah,
you feel it. And it's so strange.
Yeah.
But it unlocks things when you do that. And of course, now we added so you can be 2 meter long, because some people are a little bit shorter. And
sure.
When you go from being 140 centimeters, or I don't know what that's in feet,
but, sure,
and going down to being a child, it's not that much difference.
Right.
But being a very long person like me, like 2 meters,
yep,
then that's a difference.
Yeah.
Yeah. Suddenly you see on top of things.
Yep.
I can see dust on top of you know, what's it called now, over a stove. You have a...
Oh, the hood.
The hood.
Yeah.
I can see if it's dust up there.
Yeah.
But my wife can't.
Yep.
So
and I can see if I can reach something, because I'm always, I don't know, my wife is, I'm the same boat. I'm always the guy who's reaching the glasses in the back.
Yeah.
That you only have at parties, you know.
Yeah. And that's something that's also something you can do, because size is fairly accurate here.
Yeah.
So you can, if you're trying out things, okay, can I store this up here? And the distance between the kitchen island and the bench, is that too wide? Or do I like this? And mm-hmm. so on. So looking at different solutions would be perfect.
And, that's really cool.
And what we said in the press release really is that we are aiming for 5 to 10 years from now.
Okay. What is your aim in 5 to 10 years?
That people can, and hopefully people have access to a device like this, simple. Like easily, like you have access to a TV screen at home.
Right.
You don't have it with you every day or when you travel or anything, like the phone, but you can have something that can handle virtual reality approximately like an HTC Vive with a high-end computer.
What about
in 5 to 10 years?
What about augmented reality? What about replacing?
Of course, super interesting. But from my point of view, I don't know if I'm right, but I think the problem is about 3 times more complicated.
It's more complicated, for sure. But it'd be great if you can go to your kitchen.
Yeah.
Kitchens are, of course, as you said, the strong point.
Yeah, but
here,
it can be just finding a chair or a sofa.
Right. Oh, yeah. How would this chair look here? Yeah, yeah, there you go.
Or a sofa. Does it fit?
Does it fit? Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course. I had my first HoloLens experience not long ago.
Yeah.
And, I want to see what a sofa would look there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this is amazing to me. I'm fascinated by that. But I want to actually go through the idea that something we mentioned, and I said I would come back to it, is the fact that VR, the assumption is that it's for games right now. And I hate that, because I think that VR is much more, almost by definition, is to take you to a place that doesn't necessarily exist, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
To take you to a place that doesn't exist or does not exist yet or whatever. And I while that's fine for games, architecture design
is the same thing.
That's the whole point. And the problem with the architect or the designer is they have this thing in their head and they can't show someone as easily as they do. So they do rendering, they do drawings.
Yeah.
But VR is the best translation for taking you to that place.
Yes.
And so I feel that that is
at
more important.
At least now, if you look at the now,
right,
feeling volume, distance, space,
okay,
maybe not color, because it's costly to make it look good.
Yeah.
But if you are okay with like the image quality from SketchUp or something like that, then you can go into that directly. There are already applications for it. So you can just take a SketchUp file, load it, and walk it.
Sure. I've seen some very good demos recently. Mm. The NoZone guys have been showing some stuff, and there's other great companies that are doing some really good stuff.
Yeah, those
as well.
Are very nice.
And so there is ways of actually moving around inside of a space that looks 100% photoreal.
Yeah, it is. The only problem there is that you have a fixed height from the floor, and that's a little bit of a problem to feel real size. But
no, not necessarily.
Okay.
Not necessarily. Volumetric VR stuff, there are solutions for that.
Mm-hmm. We'll see.
And that's going to, this is a field that changes all the time, right?
Yeah.
But I think that there's going to be a lot of challenges to make things look real. So now the experience is like the aha moment, the experience, but there is, as you said, there is that moment where the graphics have gone back to something that are not necessarily the quality that you guys are used to in the IKEA catalog, et cetera.
No.
So how are you fighting that challenge right there?
You mean to getting the image quality we want to? Yeah. Time will help us.
Okay.
That's why you have
2020.
Yeah, that's
right?
Why 5 to 10 years.
Right.
But you can use it without having the photoreal quality, and it still is useful and gives you information that is good.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And for some reason, I have not got a clue, but for some reason, at least we experience, is that people are okay with less image quality if they are totally immersed in it.
Okay.
Because you accept it as
but do you think
that,
that
world.
Do you think that that's because that's the first time they've experienced that? And once they get used to that, so...
Yeah, of course, we always want to have better quality.
Because when they get used to that, then someone else... come on, you were just talking about your computer. The first time you played Pac-Man on it, it was like, the graphics are amazing.
Yeah,
you know?
And of course.
Now, of course, that's intolerable, right?
Yeah.
So obviously that's going to change. Now VR is like, okay, this is the limit of VR, but there's this different things that are happening. So I'm curious to see what's going to happen.
Yeah, I think in 15 years we will have the image quality that you get from like a renderer like V-Ray, but
right,
in real time.
In real time.
Yeah, so it depends on the time frame we're talking about.
Yeah.
If the speed of computers continue in the way they have, but it seems to be accelerating, so maybe it will go faster. But if it keeps doing what it has done the last 10 years or 15 years, then it's like 10, 15 years away. But it probably would go faster.
It could be even faster.
Yeah, it will probably be
but,
faster.
But there's going to be several steps that need to take place, and it's going to be a combination of hardware and software, obviously.
Yeah.
Hardware is really going to be, it's all about GPU rendering or massive multi-threading processing, right?
Yeah.
And cloud rendering possibly even.
Yeah.
Once you basically, this laptop I have right here, it's a nice laptop. It's actually a pretty powerful laptop, but it's small, et cetera. There is a lot of applications now that I can run on a Chromebook that cost $220. As long as I have a fast internet connection and
you can get it streamed over.
And
yeah,
I can get high quality work. I can get it on my phone if I had to.
Yeah.
So I think that cloud computing and GPU stuff is going to make all of that possible.
Yeah, the problem now with anything that has a fairly high quality is that it has the cables.
Right.
And connections to anything.
And to become
really big, it has to get the cables away.
Right.
And the only problem is that I haven't seen anything that can handle really high quality without consuming energy.
Mm-hmm.
So, nope. So either you have a 4-minute experience or you lower the quality and you get a 2-hour experience.
Sure.
So, but there are people looking at that too, trying to consume less energy and at the same time as you get high quality rendering. So that would probably solve itself too.
I think it's going to be an interesting balance to find out. And I think it's going to be a dynamic shift, right? Because like you said, how immersive it is.
Yeah,
really is dependent on several things, one of which is very much frame rate, right?
Yeah.
So if your frame rate's high enough, then it's much more immersive. But then when the frame rate's very high, then it makes it very hard to do high quality. So then where is that balance and when is that tipping point?
Yeah, and then, of course, if you're talking virtual reality, when you're taking hold of the whole view, it's more of a problem. Because
sure.
you have to make everything work.
Right.
If you're talking about mixed reality and only adding a few things, then the real reality will shine through, and that's non-compute power.
Right.
So
that was one thing I definitely liked about the augmented reality thing I saw in the HoloLens, is that I still was connected back to the real world.
Yes. Yeah.
And so there's a little bit of, I mean, I'm sure you experienced this, or I'm sure you know people who experience it. I mean, put on a headset and you're in this virtual world, you're self-conscious because you feel like you're vulnerable to the real world. People are outside looking at you, talking.
Some people are. Yeah. And some people just get loose. So
right.
they don't care.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But some people are like, yeah, am I going to bump into a wall? Where is that person?
I would say that it's half-half.
Yeah.
Half of the people are standing and are really afraid of walking.
Right.
And some people are so immersed that so they could walk straight into a wall and
smack into things. Yeah.
So that's it's... I think it's 50-50.
There was a cute video, but it was kind of sad.
Yeah. Okay.
But it was this cooking, you know, the cooking thing that they do on the Vive, right? There's like a cooking game.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And there was this little girl, same thing, right? She's a little girl, so she's short, right? And she couldn't reach. And she was trying, she really imagined she was in a kitchen, but the reality is there's nothing in front of her.
Yeah.
And so she wanted to reach for a pan, and so she tried to lean against the cabinet.
Yeah, yeah. But
that
it wasn't
was not there.
No.
To reach for the pan, and she just fell smacked on it.
We have been saving our hand controllers a few times because in the experience we have created, it's a kitchen island in the middle, and we say, okay, now the experience is over, and people are like, okay, I will put the hand controllers here.
They drop it.
And you had to get them before they hit the floor.
Yeah. Yep, I've done that. I've done that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've actually seen someone. It was interesting that, what did they do? They matched, they put a real version in a VR version. So the table is in the same space that it is in virtual reality.
Yeah.
And so I'm looking at a virtual table and I put my hands down, and although I don't see my hands, they're touching a table.
We have that. It's actually part of the thing you can download from Steam. If you press 5 on the numeric keyboard, you will be transported to a place in the scene that is fixed. You can't really do anything.
Sure.
And then a chair appears.
Okay.
It's, of course, one that we sell.
Right.
And if you have that chair, and if you have made the calibration we have described, then you can put it on those marks you have put on the floor.
Uh-huh.
And then you can go and reach for it and feel how the virtual and real world interact.
Oh,
and we did that with all the 1,000 people. So,
right.
And that was superb because it's really there.
Yeah.
The only problem, as you said, you don't see your hands, but you can feel the screws, you can feel all the features, and it's the right size. It works.
Yeah, that's really surreal.
Yeah, it is.
Really, really surreal. And I think it was interesting. There's, I don't know, there was an interesting discussion. Kim Bauman, Lars, do you know Kim, right?
Yeah, yes, my name.
Yeah. He sent out a podcast from the Road to VR podcast. I forgot what the name of their actual podcast series, but it's from that website.
Okay.
About architectural scale in VR and how the scale is because people don't see their own hands or their own...
I've heard that podcast. Yeah.
Wasn't it interesting?
Yeah, it was interesting.
It was interesting because basically because you don't see your own body image inside of virtual reality, that the world...
You lose your reference.
You lose your reference and the world seems slightly... Perceptually, they were averaging about 20% smaller is what they were estimating. But it's interesting to think about that.
I think it depends on what device you are running. What we have seen is that if you have the correct floor height,
yeah,
to the one you have, if you're standing up and mm-hmm. you have a headset on, and if the floor in the virtual world and in the real world are in the same place, then the world is correct.
Right.
If you're two, 3 or 1 inch too high,
yeah,
then the world will seem too small.
Right.
And 1 inch lower, and you are so sensitive of the floor height.
Yes.
So the rendered camera, has to be on the same height as the person you're showing it to.
Right.
So if you have somebody who is like 1 feet off in either direction mm-hmm. towards that, then you need to re-render or give them a new image.
Okay.
And it's strange because if you think you have different shoes on, but yep. you seem to be calibrating that on the fly.
Mm-hmm.
So it's super strange. So in the experience we have created, we had to
But the Vive knows your head height.
Yeah, it does. But it actually, when every time you start it, it's a little bit up and down.
Interesting.
So we have in the application we've created, we have a fine calibration on page up, page down, 1 centimeter up and down, half mm-hmm. an inch up and down.
Okay.
Because of this is so important. And then, of course, you have the interpupillar distance, the distance between your eyes. And
which is critical.
Critical. It's very critical. So you have to have that correct also. And if you have that, at least from what I understand, the interpupillar distance will be important up to 10 meters. But then after that, the angular distance, the difference between your eyes are like so little. So it's more important shading and textures and anti-aliasing and all of the other things. But the closer you get, the more the distance between the eyes are important.
I've always felt that a lot of VRs, that everything has always seemed slightly small to me.
Mm.
And I think it's because my interpupillar distance is very small.
Okay.
So
yeah.
The distance between my eyes is smaller than the average, right? Because most, for example, if you're going to do cube map stuff, which a lot of people do, we usually advise them to some distance, and we try to set it to the most average distance that people have, right?
And you will feel the difference is plus minus a millimeter.
Yeah.
So it's very. I have 68, and if I go down to 65, and I feel it directly or up.
Yeah, because I'm 59.
Yeah, okay.
Big difference.
Yeah, it's totally different. And the thing we are looking into now is that we feel that it's as much as 20% is not, at least in our tests, we think we are like off 1% count maybe.
Right.
So on 1 meter thing, we feel that something is like 1 centimeters or 2 centimeters smaller if we set the IPD. So we are just now looking into that together with Valve and HTC and see if we can get that to work.
I'd love to know the like if you guys release a paper about it or something, I'd love to
probably
hear
not. But we will see what we
come
can
on.
Do.
Come on, well, give me the information. I'll make a paper about it.
You can do that.
I'll put it in our guide to VR.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, that's really cool. Is there any other cool stuff that you guys are doing that you can talk about? Probably not. But
probably not.
But you are looking into some more interesting stuff for sure, right?
Yeah, I mean, my passion is around pure computer graphics, and as I said, it's reborn now with the VR thing. And, but it also feels like you are going back to what you did in the 90s with cube maps and normal shadow maps and all the sheets that you did back then. You're doing now, but they are doing that so much faster, so it will go faster. But
I'm going to give you my little pitch about this, right? So, and I've said this a couple of times, and I'll say it again. Maybe if I say it enough times, people will believe me. Real time, as you mentioned, real time will replace offline rendering. You're not going to wait for renders anymore. You don't want to. You're not going to want to wait for renders. So real time will eventually replace any offline rendering. But that's not the correct question, because I really think the question is, will scanline rasterized rendering replace ray tracing? And I don't think that's the case. I think the ultimate goal is to ray trace.
It's the opposite.
Yeah. So right now, there's a demand for higher quality rendering again.
but it's the same thing we already done.
Right.
So it's I don't see.
But now we just have to have it in real time.
But if you compare with what I did in the 90s, the thing we did then,
mm-hmm.
and actually could charge money for.
Right.
is what you see live in the viewport.
Right.
Yep. So And then we had to wait to get that.
Like an hour or more.
Yeah, or more. So
now you're getting it in 1/30th of a second.
Or 1/60th of a second. Yeah, and you think of it not even as a preview. You think of it as that's the user interface.
Right.
Yes, like getting shaded stuff in the viewport. Right. It's like, that's, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the point I'm coming to is that we are always, we have all the time tried to do everything in real time.
Mm-hmm.
So it is no difference with offline or online rendering. It's the same goal. It's getting it as fast as possible.
Yep.
So the difference we have now, when we have compared with the kitchen we made,
mm-hmm.
if we made a still image in the same resolution with the same, approximately the same quality when rendering with V-Ray, we waited 10 minutes.
Right.
Yeah. And we needed to get that done in 90 frames per second. So 11 milliseconds.
Right.
And that's only 60,000 times faster.
Only, yeah.
Only, yeah. Right. But if you look back, 60,000 times faster was like in 2000.
Right.
So it's comparing
16
what we
years
did.
Ago. Yeah.
Yeah, 16 years ago, we would have waited 10 minutes for what we get in real time now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
So okay, 16 years from now, yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Or even faster, because things goes faster now. So
I think, honestly, there's several things that smarter programming and the ability to adapt to new environments is key.
Parallel stuff.
But parallel, and we're kind of right. It's a lot of it is dependent on hardware, and if we get these new GPUs to work as fast as they're promising to be, then it'll be possible for sure. It'll be possible. It'd be very close.
Yeah. We want light and materials and everything to behave as close as it does in the real world, and that's why we want to have been using the tools you have been doing.
Yeah.
So why shouldn't we want that in real time?
Right. Exactly.
It's only compute power that makes us want to like bake it down or whatever we do. So
yep. Agreed.
And we did that before too. So it's just the same thing. So it's not contradicting each other.
No.
It's the same thing.
Yeah. And I think it's going to happen, honestly. I think that there's a lot of tools out there that are making it happen. I know a few things that are going on as well on the hardware side and software side of things. But it's really fascinating. I think people will really love to hear it. Every time you talk at an event, people are kind of blown away because they, a lot of them are working on big movies and they're talking about all this fancy stuff they're doing, explosions, et cetera. And then you come around and you're like, here's how things will operate at IKEA. And to them, their eyes open up because they see how interesting it is. And at the same time, it's so approachable because they know what going to an IKEA store is about. And they live around that type of furniture and that type of lifestyle all their lives. So to them, it just bridges the gap between their home life and their work life. That's got to be a challenge for you.
I actually had like 3 years ago, I was visiting Pixar and having a presentation in their building.
Uh-huh.
And I remember one of the responses I got afterwards, and they said, okay, we can see the IKEA store from here. Right. We will look at that a little bit differently now.
Yeah.
Yeah. I still remember that one.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. I ever since I saw your talk, I think differently when I go to an IKEA store. And I love it. I think it's really cool besides the meatballs. But I think it's a great thing, actually. They're building a giant new IKEA in where I live in Burbank.
Okay.
The Burbank IKEA that's there now, I think, was one of the first ones in the United States.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
And then the new one is going to be like,
I think the count is now 375.
Really? Yeah. I would have thought it would be more than that.
But it's a lot.
And it is a lot.
175,000 coworkers.
Wow. Okay.
Is it the
biggest company in Sweden? Or one of the biggest companies?
Yeah, I guess it's the biggest. I don't know.
Yeah.
I would guess so.
Yeah. And is it outside of Stockholm or is it in Stockholm?
It's in the south of Sweden. It's like 2 hours train or car drive north of Malmö or Copenhagen.
Okay.
Straight in the woods. So it's nothing else there.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's.
And you said you were telling me how you actually live pretty far from there and you have a long commute, right?
Yeah, I have a long commute. I have a 1.5 hour one way and no traffic. And
so you live in the middle of nowhere.
No, I actually live on the west coast, just alongside the coastline, seeing the sea. So And I almost, yeah, many mornings I listen to this podcast.
Oh, so, that's cool.
Yeah, so I will probably hear myself. Hi, don't drive off the road.
Okay. All right. Well, this has been great, Martin. I appreciate it. This has been, like I said, it's been, that's exactly the kind of podcast I wanted to introduce to people, because this is kind of things that people want. So yeah,
nice.
Great.
Nice meeting. All right. You.
Well, I'm going to let the last bucket drop, even though we won't be using them much in the future, because it'll be real time. But hopefully we'll get to see you again, and we'll see you on SIGGRAPH. I'm sure we'll see each other at the parties.
Yeah.
All right. Take care. Bye. Thanks, guys. Bye.